From 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR, this is Lake Effect. I'm Audrey Nowakowski. Today on the show, we explore the connection between racial inequality and the COVID-19 pandemic. Then we learn how the isolation brought on by the pandemic can lend insight into the isolation caused by dementia.
For the first time, I really feel like we have this understanding of what the experience of isolation in late life can be. And we're in a situation where we can empathize with that more.
Plus, we hear from the curator of this year's Sculpture Milwaukee about how some of the work is reflective of what's going on today.
I feel very fortunate that our board was really committed to putting Sculpture Milwaukee on this year, despite all this, all of the problems that we've had. But we really do think that this is a year when public art can really be part of the discussion about what we're going through.
Lake Effect is next, but first the news. This is Lake Effect from 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR. Thanks for tuning in today. I'm Audrey Nowakowski. The second annual Minority Health Film Festival kicks off in Milwaukee today. Between now and September 24th, 50 films, events, and discussions will highlight how institutions and communities impact the health of marginalized groups. Of course, due to the COVID-19 pandemic, this festival will be virtual, with the exception of some drive-in events. Dr. Kamara Jones gave the keynote speech for the festival today. Jones is a family physician and epidemiologist whose work focuses on naming, measuring, and addressing the impacts of racism on the health and well-being of people. She spoke with WUWM race and ethnicity reporter Taryn Powell about people of color bearing the brunt of the COVID-19 virus and how the nation can begin to work towards health equity.
Black and brown and indigenous folks are overrepresented among those who are infected and then overrepresented among those who are dying from COVID-19 is not because we are more susceptible. We are no more susceptible to this virus than anybody else. At the beginning in 2019, December, there was no human on this planet who was immune to this virus. What we are is we're more likely to get infected because we're more exposed and less protected. And then once infected, we're more likely to die because we're more burdened by chronic diseases with less access to health care. Now, each of those things, more exposed, why are we more exposed? Well, first of all, we're more likely to be in those poorly paid frontline jobs, you know, grocery clerks, bus drivers, you know, mail delivery people, warehouse workers, in the meat packing plants, poultry packing plants. And why are we more likely to be in those frontline jobs? It's because when the federal government solidified racially segregated communities in this country, I mean, that's been the case over centuries, but especially in the 20th century, where the VA and the FHA and all of these federal agencies solidified racially segregated communities and then disinvested in those communities. Now you have poor communities, and when the schools are supported by local property tax and you have poorly funded schools, which turns into poor educational outcomes and often, and another generation lost, and then those poorly educated people, what job opportunities do they have? So it's directly out of that line. So that's racism in one thing. Then why are we less protected, right? Well, even though we're essential workers in these jobs, we're not highly valued. We're not valued in our pay. We're not valued in personal protective equipment, not valued with hazard pay or, you know, family and medical leave. You know, so we're less protected in terms of on the job or even being able to stay away from the job when the job is hazardous. Then why are we more burdened by chronic diseases? It has the same thing to do with the disinvestment and crowding into communities where you have environmental hazards, no access or limited access to green space, crowded housing, public transportation, if you can get it, you know, no access to healthy foods or very limited at high price access to healthy foods. All of these things, all of these adverse neighborhood conditions, which are not even provoking action. And very often, racism, especially structural racism, shows up as inaction in the face of need. So that's making us sicker. That's giving us more of the diabetes, more of the high blood pressure, more of the kidney disease, the asthma, and all of those things that once you get infected with the virus are going to cause you to have a worse outcome. And then what about the healthcare system? So everything I've said so far has nothing to do with healthcare. It has to do with the conditions of our lives. But then, even in terms of the healthcare, first of all, especially early on in the pandemic, Black folks were showing up at hospitals to be evaluated and sent home to die without even getting a temperature taken or a COVID-19 test. The testing centers were located in affluent areas, and especially at the beginning, they were drive up. What if you don't have a car? Requiring a doctor's, order. What if you don't have ready access to a primary care doctor? So all of that. And even once you get in the hospital, these criteria that hospitals are drawing up to govern how they're going to deal with the situation if they have one ventilator left and 10 people who need it, these crisis standards of care are baking into the criteria of who is going to get that last ventilator, whether or not you have kidney disease, whether or not you have diabetes, and putting people who have those conditions at lower chance of getting the life-saving equipment that they need, the therapies that they might need. And so that's baking in the structural racism that's already in our bodies, baking it into that how we're going to care for folks.
I like the way you broke down that there are really levels to the disadvantages that are stacked against Black, Indigenous, and other people of color, from the divestment in our communities to the lack of transportation, the jobs that we work, each really continuing to impact our health. And people who don't have a reason to pay attention to these types of issues likely aren't aware of how extensive the problem is.
Many people who don't live in those neighborhoods, never even go through those neighborhoods, don't even understand the conditions in those neighborhoods, and really don't understand that there are people living in those neighborhoods who are just as kind, funny, generous, hardworking, smart as they are, but living in very different circumstances. And there are people in this country who blame folks who are trapped in some of these disinvested neighborhoods, blame them as being lazy or stupid. If they just worked harder, they would be able to get out.
Exactly.
So I just want to share that there are 7 different things that characterize how we look at one another in this country. I am now calling these values targets, that are making the government and many people who are better off or, in power, blind to the conditions that are not only causing folks to be more affected by COVID-19, but God forbid we have COVID-21. If we don't change these conditions or H1N1 24, I mean, we as a world are getting so close to the so-called natural environment, and there are going to be so many more crossovers of animal diseases to humans. And if we do not change the structured inequity in our societies, then every pandemic that comes through, every flood, every hurricane, everything is going to continue to pound on the same people. We need to value all of us equally. We need to recognize and rectify historical injustices, and we need to provide resources according to need. Those are actually 3 principles for achieving health equity that I have distilled.
I'm actually glad you brought up those 3 principles for achieving health equity, because I was going to bring them up. I saw them in an article that you wrote for Newsweek back in April of this year. Summarize what you mean by each of those principles and how we might see them in practice in the healthcare system.
Well, when you value all individuals and populations equally, first of all, you're going to make sure that if you value folks, you're going to have their voice at decision-making tables, right? When you're trying to figure out something that pertains to them. So it means reaching out to communities and all kinds of folks. If you're trying to figure out what are we going to do about the disproportionate impact of COVID-19 on Black and brown communities, you need to bring Black and brown community voices to those decision-making mm-hmm. tables. They could give you a lot of insight about what we need to be doing, right? So often people at decision-making tables think they have all the knowledge and expertise and perspective that they need, and they don't reach out to the communities that are being affected.
Right.
For that second principle, recognizing and rectifying historical injustices, first of all, what it means is that each of us needs to know, first of all, our full U.S. history, and so many of our textbooks don't have our full histories. They might have one or two paragraphs about, the enslaved Africans and African descendants, and depict them as happy or whatever. Even these days, there is an attempt to say that we cannot teach about or talk about the 401 years now of the presence of Africans brought to this country in chains, enslaved, as very well written in the 1619 Project of the New York Times. There's been pushback by some people to say that we can't look at that. So we have to know our full history. Then we should each know the history of the neighborhood we're in, the city we're in. And if you are a decision maker, you need to, if you're trying to untie a knot, if you have a thorny problem that you're trying to solve, wouldn't it behoove you? Wouldn't it be good for you to know how that knot was tied, to look at the history of how the if you're trying to do something about housing in such and such a neighborhood, well, how did the housing get like that? When did the highway come through? What was up with that? Who was, forcefully removed by eminent domain, and who was not paid or not relocated? So we need to understand history. We need to, first of all, recognize and then rectify historical injustices. And then how do we provide resources according to need? Now, the first thing is to recognize that I didn't say provide resources equally. There's a difference between equality and equity. Equity is when you provide people with what they need.
Dr. Jones, you say your work is really helping people to name, measure, and address racism. And it just made me think about Milwaukee County declaring racism a public health crisis. If you were working with Milwaukee County officials, what would you say to them about how to keep that conversation going and turn it into action? Because, of course, it's not enough to just declare racism this crisis. I mean, it's great to declare that, right? That's the first step. But how do we turn that declaration into action?
So first of all, I have to congratulate Milwaukee County for being the first to make that formal declaration of racism as a public health crisis in May of 2019. So that's more than a year ago. And what would I say to Milwaukee County now? I say you need to make sure that you're not just running things by the community in terms of what you're planning to do or this, but that you are asking the community to help you develop an agenda, that you are in solid partnership with that every committee that you have, every county agency and all, that you have very, very strong mechanisms for sustained community input. So that's the first thing, that this is a partnership, because a declaration is one thing. You're saying, okay, Milwaukee, hold us accountable. We've declared racism to be a public health crisis. We've said the word, now hold us accountable. But to really be accountable, you have to be in partnership with people and you have to be willing to listen. So that's the first thing. That's the valuing all individuals and populations equally. That's how it would be manifest there. You also have to be willing to invest deeply in communities that have been historically disinvested. So you need to actually put more resources in communities. You need to clean up environmental hazards. There should be nobody living in what the Environmental Protection Agency would call a sacrifice zone. That's a real thing. They call some communities sacrifice zones because they are right next to known polluting industries. You should be investing in Black business. So the partner, you know, in terms of who does the work, you need to be investing in Black schools. Now, I know that there's no such thing as a Black school because, you know, it's all public schools or whatever. But there are, because we look at, you know, the racial segregation in our neighborhoods, which turns into racial segregation in our schools. We need to be investing, enriching the poor rocky soil of some communities until it's as rich as the richest fertile soil in other communities in the area, right? And so that's when you're talking about recognizing and rectifying historical injustices. The third thing you have to do is to, and I guess I just said it in terms of recognizing and rectifying, that providing resources according to need. The resources could be early childhood education. The resources could be better public transportation to all parts of everywhere. Of the three principles I gave, when you provide resources according to need, then that is a way of recognizing and rectifying historical injustices. And it, in recognizing and rectifying historical injustices, that is a way of valuing all individuals and populations equally. So if I had to pick one of those principles to guide how you go forward, look at the need in the area. Just document the need. I'm sure it's already in all kinds of tables and graphs everywhere. And then provide resources according to need, which might mean that some folks go a year, 2 years, maybe a decade without additional resources until you bring the other folks up. This is not just giving a little bit of something on the top. We're not trying to ice this cake. There's a huge hole in the cake, and we need to fill that up first before we can put some icing on top of it.
Support for Race and Ethnicity Reporting is provided by the Doman Company Foundation.
Dr. Kamara Jones is an epidemiologist and an expert in the connection between race and health. She was the keynote speaker for Milwaukee Film's Minority Health Film Festival, and she spoke with WUWM's race and ethnicity reporter, Taryn Powell. Coming up, we'll learn how dementia care can help all of us deal with isolation brought on by the COVID-19 pandemic. This is Lake Effect on Milwaukee's NPR. Lake Effect Now on WUWM. I'm Audrey Nowakowski. The COVID-19 pandemic has thrust many of us into isolation, both physically and, in some cases, socially. While this isolation can feel disheartening, for most of us it will be temporary. But that's not the case for people with dementia. Ann Basting works with the elderly and people experiencing dementia through her organization, Time Slips. She's also the author of a new book called Creative Care: A Revolutionary Approach to Dementia and Elder Care. Basting says the isolation brought on by the pandemic has been an eye-opening experience, giving her greater insight into what many people with dementia experience every day. She joins Lake Effect's Joy Powers to talk about how her work can help everyone cope with isolation and how that work has evolved to fit the needs of this pandemic.
So the groups that you most frequently work with, it seems, are nursing homes and elderly people, or at least that's a big part of your work. What are some of the challenges that you're continuing to face in reaching people during this pandemic?
The bulk of my work has been using the arts as a way to create relationship and have people connect with each other across differences. The arts are an emotional and symbolic language that we can communicate in. And 30 years ago, my work started when I realized that the arts, and particularly improvisation, would work with really well for communication and expression with people with dementia. And that, of course, is where Time Slips really got its start. Going from there, I've really seen the arts as just in general as a way for people to connect and build meaningful relationship. Now, in this time of COVID and the pandemic, we've just seen a surge of yearning for connection. So we've been busy, and I've been busy trying to figure out how to get the tools of engagement out into the hands of caregivers who now find themselves alone at home with their loved one because senior centers and support systems have shut down, rightly so. Care communities that are under direction from the state to not have engagement, even communal activities or dining, until they demonstrate a reduction in infection really across the whole state until we enter phase three.
Now, you mentioned, of course, people with dementia. And I have to imagine, you know, the moment we're living in is really difficult for a lot of people, but particularly people who might be more easily confused. How are people with dementia doing during this time, just in general?
I think it's really instructive to, well, let me back up and say that dementia is a disease of isolation. That isolation is caused by brain activity that makes it harder to register what's happening for your thoughts, concepts. And so you tend to shut down communication and relationship. Hearing can be part of that, challenges of actually just expressing and understanding what's happening in the world. And on top of that, then you have the stigma of it and people's really kind of irrational fears about how to engage with people with dementia. So it becomes, for both the caregiver and the person with dementia, an experience of isolation. Now, of course, we find ourselves in a moment when everyone is isolated. So for the first time, I really feel like we have this understanding of what the experience of isolation in late life can be. And we're in a situation where we can empathize with that more. And we've really been using that as a way to bridge that gap with some of the work that's been happening at TimeSlips and my own research, to bring people into relationship through programs with the mail, programs with the telephone that have really evolved over the last couple months.
You know, as you say, your work, while people might not look at it initially and go, oh, this is the moment for your kind of work, this moment that we're living through does lend itself so much to the kind of work that you do with the elderly, with a lot of different groups who might be more isolated. How does your expertise inform the advice that you're giving to people right now?
Well, I've got a lot of expertise now, not only from the practice of the last 30 years of bringing the arts into long-term care, but also, you know, personally from feeling that sting of isolation personally now, understanding what that feels like. And even last spring with my students, feeling what it felt like for them and understanding that. Just the pain of isolation and loneliness. And then I also have in my own family challenges with dementia as well. So the experience is actually compounded by the pandemic, by aging in my own family, and then building on these 30 years, which was really the story from Creative Care, from the book that came out in May.
Yes, so you have this book. Can you tell us a bit about that and how it relates to the pandemic and the conditions that people are living in?
So Creative Care, it's subtitled A Revolutionary Approach to Dementia and Elder Care, came out in May. A really, really hard time for books to come out because it just, everything had changed. We found that the beauty of Zoom kind of book readings was quite lovely, particularly people who really can benefit from this book, which really caregivers, both family and professional, who are all feeling isolated. So to be in a warm, supportive environment of the intimacy that Zoom can bring you, everybody in their living rooms or their bedrooms or their homes, really sharing experiences and stories of caregiving. So that I think has been a positive outcome. You know, bookstores and book distribution and all of that aside, and trying to crack into the news to share you know, stories about the book coming out as a helpful tool for people have been challenging. The book itself is a story of the last 25, 30 years of my work, how I got into this field personally, my own story of that, and then breaking down the elements of creative care so that people can use them very hands-on. Beautiful questions, improvisation, offering proof of listening. Those are just three of about six chapters that give really concrete steps for how people can incorporate those into their lives. And then the third section is all about what happens if we infuse these approaches into care systems. And that is really helpful right now because we find that care systems and all systems really are broken. They're breaking under the weight of their own fragility. This moment is really revealing the cracks in those systems. And there's been, I think, a tremendous creativity in trying to meet the needs of the moment. I think that these approaches really can help us see beyond this moment to how we could infuse them more into our care systems.
So let's dig into a couple of these approaches, especially right now. I think there's so many people who are looking for ways to cope with isolation, with not being able to see friends and family, the very many things that come along with the anxiety of this moment. What are some of the ways that you advise people to cope through this?
I really advise bringing two things together. Creativity, which is generative and purposeful and positive and playful, and generosity. Both of those, research shows us, relax us, help to pass time, help improve our well-being. And those are all things that we need right now. And you get a double whammy of it when you combine creativity and generosity. And what I mean, like examples of how you could do that, time slips set up almost right away when the pandemic hit. We set out an inquiry to all of the care homes that we've collaborated with over the years. And we said, do you want mail? And about over 150 of them responded and said, yes, please. So we on the website have a list of those places that want mail. And we offer guidance in how to send a postcard with a positive message. And even a little drawing or a poem, any kind of little hopeful creative effort that you can share and just share your well wishes with people. That is a generosity, putting a postcard stamp on there and taking the time out to send well wishes to someone you don't know to brighten their day. And it's also creative, and it invites the person on the other side to respond creatively as well. That's just a simple example. We've tracked, since we started tracking, I think in May, over 11,000 postcards that have been generated from that project.
Wow. Last time we talked, you explained a variety of different ways that you were continuing to engage with people through creative outlets. I'm curious. Of course, there are these postcards. There are other ways that we've talked about previously. What are some of the things that have evolved during this pandemic in your work?
The postcard project, for sure. And then also the another element of it has been distributing beautiful questions, very simple questions that open up a shared path of discovery, inviting people to see their lives in a little bit of a different way. We printed four beautiful question postcards and distributed those to care homes across the United States. We shared them also with the John Michael Kohler Art Center, who distributed them in the Sheboygan community. We've been sharing them everywhere we can. And there's an 800 number on the back so that whoever receives that beautiful question can call in and share their response with us. And then TimeSlips is gathering those audio responses into and sharing them in some way. They might be kind of an audio collage that we share back, hoping to do some partnership with Wisconsin Stories through Wisconsin Public Radio. Just that's a whole another beautiful thing. We've had some care systems from across the country that have contacted us saying, we'd love to distribute the beautiful question through our whole care network, through our home delivered meals, Meals on Wheels systems, through any kind of system that is in place to reach out to older adults who are isolated, whether they have dementia or not. The phrasing of those questions are usually pretty accessible so that people with dementia can participate and their caregivers can do it with them as a relationship building practice. So another way that we that TimeSlips adapted in this moment was to shift to the telephone. I think, you know, Zoom is awesome and all these techno gizmos that are helping us connect at this moment are fantastic. But not everyone has Wi-Fi, not everyone has tablets or smartphones or broadband. So we shifted to offer what we call telestories. And right now we have a pilot in Milwaukee where we were able to hire 10 artists, train them in our facilitated story technique. And now they are reaching out, each artist is reaching out each week to 10 older adults over 12 weeks for story exchanges. And then those artists will create something from their own expertise in the arts at the end of those 12 weeks. It's a really beautiful way to ease isolation for both the artists and the older adults. And we're really proud of that project and thankful to the Greater Milwaukee Foundation for that funding.
Well, Anne, thank you so much for joining us here on Lake Effect and sharing so much of your work.
No problem. It was a joy. Thank you.
Anne Basting is the founder of TimeSlips and the author of Creative Care, a revolutionary approach to dementia and elder care. She spoke with Lake Effect's Joy Powers. We'll take one last break and then hear from the curator of this year's Sculpture Milwaukee. Lake Effect returns in a moment on WUWM. Lake Effect continues now on Milwaukee's NPR. I'm Audrey Nowakowski. There's at least one Milwaukee attraction that never had to close during the coronavirus pandemic. Sculpture Milwaukee is a nonprofit organization responsible for filling downtown Milwaukee with outdoor art. The current exhibit will be on display for the next year. Sculpture Milwaukee has created one of the most robust collections of contemporary public art in the country. Mary Lou Knode is the Director of Curatorial Affairs and Education at Sculpture Milwaukee and this year's curator. She's been involved with the arts community for more than 30 years, and she spoke with Lake Effect's Becca Schimmel about the current exhibit.
How has Sculpture Milwaukee adapted to the pandemic and the protests and just a different year than really anyone expected?
Well, I will just say that the curatorial team has been working on the exhibition this year since last summer. So the minute every show opens, you're on. You keep moving forward to think about what might be relevant for this year. There's no doubt about the fact that when the pandemic hit and the economic climate for fundraising changed, we had really hoped to program up by about 30% more artworks because of the DNC and the incredible visibility of the city. But we had to really reduce things quite a bit for the reality of everything. We also had to delay our installation period because a lot of the work that we get is in New York, some in Los Angeles, and some in the UK this year, and quite a few works from Chicago. But, you know, if galleries close and the shippers are not working, there's nothing we can do. We do not have our hands on the artworks that we borrow from other people, from both galleries and artists. So we were delayed quite a bit. Getting the works out of the UK was tricky because we had a window of opportunity that kept moving. And it's funny because in January I was working on borrowing a work that by a British artist that was in China. And that window closed much sooner than anything else. So I have to say that I had a foretaste of what we were going to be going through with that particular work that we were not able to borrow because the museum was shut down by the time we needed to get it going. So in any case, we have a very nimble team of about 100 people, over 100 people, shippers, riggers, marketing folks, the curators, the team for fundraising, our board, our volunteers. So everybody has just been sort of reacting to the reality of our world. However, we are already physically distanced with what we do. You know, work is outside. And so we really are hoping that people who need just something to take their minds off of or to embed how artists reflect your world back to you. Sculpture Milwaukee is a really great chance to just get outside, get some exercise, maybe see other people, because I know that that's a really important thing for me right now. So, you know, I feel very fortunate that our board was really committed to putting Sculpture Milwaukee on this year, despite all this, you know, all of the problems that we've had. But we really do think that this is a year when public art can really be part of the discussion about what we're going through.
So tell me a little bit about this year's Sculpture Milwaukee.
So we have 19 artworks by 19 artists. Four of those artworks overwintered from last year. And I use that word on purpose because nobody really overwinters in Milwaukee. You either live here or you leave town for warmer climes. But, you know, we are really mindful of the fact that we like to keep the exhibition alive for people through the winter months. One of the impacts of COVID-19 is that many more of the works from this year's exhibition are going to be living through the winter into the spring and probably through 2021. And that's just a really great way for us to reflect the normal practice of our colleagues in museums where you have things up all year round. And it also gives people a chance to see the works in the fall and under snow, in the spring when the leaves change color, come back. So, you know, I feel like in many ways we've been able to adapt because you have a very inventive group of people that we're working with.
What are some of the artworks that really stood out to you in this year's Sculpture Milwaukee?
I love the piece. It's deeply meaningful to me because of the layers of work. Layers of meaning that he brings to us. The art history references I always appreciate because it allows me to activate, you know, my medieval art history class with Marilyn Stockstad, and just to think about, you know, how do we look into the past and what the Greeks did to help us understand Western art history. Thomas Price is hacking into that art history by using the formal qualities of sculpture, but presenting a very, very timely bit of content to it. And that really changes how we look at art history. And I really appreciate that. I really love The Blob Monster. I find a great deal of meaning in Neri Ward's piece, Apollo Pole. You know, the Apollo Theater is certainly very important. Isabel Wilkerson, in her book, A Warmth of Other Suns, talked about the Great Black Migration, and the Apollo Theater was part of that, where artists, you know, performing artists of color could present their work to their audiences and create a really very vibrant place for, you know, theater, music, singers, etc. The fact that he has the sign flipped between Apollo and Pole is very current, where, you know, access to voting is really very much compromised, not just by voter ID laws, but by the pandemic. So again, that work had meaning a year ago when I asked to borrow the work for Sculpture Milwaukee, but it's extremely meaningful for us today. Now, we put that piece at the Wisconsin Center District, which was to be the corner of where the DNC was held, I do know that some of my colleagues across the country saw it in some of the coverage, but it wasn't nearly the kind of sort of vibrant beacon that we had hoped for. I think it still has a great deal of resonance for us. We are looking to work with some folks to do voter registration at the Apollo poll. The problem being there are very few people downtown right now. So I don't know, it's going to be hard for us to register a lot of people to vote downtown. But we just really want to support people in our community who are already doing that kind of voter registration. And then Leslie Hewitt is another artist of color whose work is about the importance of Black-owned bookstores and their disappearance for various reasons. I think the Paula Crown piece in the Third Ward, her work is talking partially about party culture and, you know, the red Solo cups that you see in the garbage, you know, in the sewers after a party weekend. But it's also about the scourge of single-use plastic. And as one of the cities that stewards one of our Great Lakes, we have to really be mindful of how that impacts us as, you know, Milwaukeeans, but also what that means for human survival. So there are all kinds of stories that are told through all of the works. Even a work like Anna Fasshauer's piece that looks like a bunch of blue straws kind of crumpled up. She's really addressing sort of the extreme macho minimalism of the 1960s and 70s and how women have for a very long time sort of attacked it by adapting some of the vocabulary, but really twisting it. So it's a very playful piece. It looks a little bit wacky, like some kid threw its, you know, her straw down, but it's very playful, but also has some real deep meaning to it.
What challenges and opportunities has the pandemic presented for Sculpture Milwaukee?
Well, I would say that we've been very nimble in making lemonade out of lemons. So the fact that we have responded to this problem by having works over winter, but really in a deliberate way, so that the exhibition really does last for a year. I think that's a really great way in which we have, kept the works here for public discussion. I think that one particular change I've made this year is that in my audio scripts, often I invite a lot of community members to talk about a work that maybe intersects with what they do for a living. So, for example, last year we had a Red Grooms hot dog vendor, and I asked Alexa Alfaro, who co-runs Meat on the Street food truck with her brother, and Alexa talked about what is it like to be a food vendor in a truck? You know, what kind of community do you have in your window? You know, your little window that sort of, you see your face and they see yours and you see theirs. There's something very playful about that. This year, I actually asked the artists to talk about their own work, and most of them responded positively. And so you're actually hearing the artists talk about some of their primary motivations for making their work. Another thing that I did this year in recognition of our isolation is I've started a reading group, and I've asked the artists what books were particularly inspiring to them for the works that we have on view. And so, for example, Neri Ward sent me a reference to a children's book about the Voting Rights Act so that parents can get that book for their kids and talk about issues that maybe helped inform Neri in his thinking about Apollo Poll. So I'm planning on us doing some reading and some book reports over the winter, and I think we'll reach out to some other community members to see if, you know, they want to tackle one of the books that the artists have represented. So lots of reading for the winter when we're all shut back inside. So if anybody is interested in a particular reading group, you know, as a curator, when I go to artist studios, I often come away with a list of about 4 books. And it's sometimes overwhelming. So at least I'm sharing this with everybody else. And you can get a sense about how artists really think deeply. I think the cliche is that artists just sort of toss things off. It's not at all true. That's a tough thing to do. And I don't think we would be showing that work if that was as shallow as your, you know, kind of engagement would be. There's all kinds of work that artists make. And I hope we've presented works that are stimulating for all the different ways in which we live as humans. You know, there are things that are fun and playful. There are things that are really pretty straightforward and help us mourn the things that are happening in our society.
To your knowledge, has there been a change in how many people are going to see and interacting with the exhibits this year?
Well, that's always a tough thing for a public art program because we don't have docents standing next to each work and clicking who walks by it. We have used sort of a balanced way to figure out how many people may have engaged with the show. There are the statistics that Visit Milwaukee has about how many people have visited Milwaukee. And we know people come downtown because that is where you see a lot of cultural organizations anyway, the Milwaukee Art Museum, all the theaters, et cetera. But, you know, because this year we were not able to have group tours working with the docents at the Milwaukee Art Museum, we don't have those statistics. But I'll continue to do tours for small groups. City Tours is doing tours for people who maybe don't want to walk along the avenue. So there's somebody who could actually take, who can take your family along Wisconsin Avenue and down into the Third Ward to see the works. We have a lot of partners who lead tours in the city. Historic Milwaukee intersects and overlaps with Sculpture Milwaukee, and we continue to sort of get their statistics. We have some educational partners who are using us to stimulate hands-on activities. But that's, you know, we really do think that because we're part of our entire community, maybe the entire community is part of our, you know, the people who enjoy what we do.
Are there sculptures in either this year or previous years that seem especially relevant right now?
So, you know, there have been a lot of topics that artists have explored over the last 4 years. You know, Richard Wood's work, which overwintered from last year, was dealing with the global housing crisis and access to affordable housing. He was thinking a little bit about the British habit of caravanning, but also all the refugee crisis that's happening in Europe. That seems to have real relevance to the United States right now because of the threat of eviction for a lot of folks who've lost their jobs. The importance of African and African diasporic beliefs and traditions in contemporary society have come up in many works. Shekiah Booker, Alison Saar, Sanford Biggers. The impact of immigration on the laws and traditions in this country, that was explored in some ways in the works of Radcliffe Bailey, Sky Hopinka, Carlos Rolón, Joan Capote. How architecture makes place, and there's a lot of works in the shows that have sort of pointed to how we form our cities and how we and our beliefs shape our reactions and interactions with place. The importance of protecting our landscape as climate changes, Roxy Payne, Carlos Rolón. So there are all these themes in every year that really sort of address things that may be really very acute this year.
How have artists you know and work with reacted to what's going on in Milwaukee, Wisconsin, and across the country, really?
Well, I would say that artists are very smart people, and they react to whatever environment they live in. So, for example, we have two British artists in the show, and Thomas Price, we've talked about at length, but Julian Opie and his Natalie Walking is thinking about the homogenization of cities, and we're losing a lot of what's really unique about place. And so by having this young woman walking in our downtown environment, you know, it's about how women have migrated into our economic centers. Are they leaders? Are they employees? You know, what role do women play in having an impact in our businesses? And there's a lot of writing about diversity of leadership of businesses makes them more sustainable and more nimble. And I wonder what we're going to be talking about it in a year, how women in leadership positions can help companies make it through this period. There's been a lot of writing about how a lot of countries' leaders that are women have helped their countries get through this pandemic. So I think we're going to all be talking about what are those points of contact for what it is that we're thinking about. Paul Druka's work, which we brought back, was commissioned in 2017, but is incredibly relevant today. He's a Milwaukee-based artist who talks about the lake and how we gather around water places. You know, access to water is one of the most important things we need as humans, but it's also often the trigger for wars. So when you think about a lot of the conflict in the Middle East, it's because who has access to the source of water. The Nile is a very contested space. The Ottoman Empire was fighting to control water, fresh water, in the Middle East in the 19th century. So, you know, there are all these touchstones that I think we'll really reflect upon in the next year.
What are the changes you all are planning for next year? Or can you tell me a little bit about what you're looking forward to about the next show?
So I will continue to bring in a good group of guest curators to help expand sort of the artist base that we work with. That's always a lot of fun. And that's a pretty typical thing too in museum practice, to bring in people with different expertise. I look forward to us having the works up through the fall, winter, and spring, because the works really do change the way we see our downtown. And I think we'll continue to need opportunities and reasons to get out of our houses in the next 6 months.
Mary Lou Canode is the Director of Curatorial Affairs and Education at Sculpture Milwaukee. She curated this year's display in downtown Milwaukee, and Canode spoke with LegFX Becca Schimmel. And that's today's edition of the show. I'm Audrey Nowakowski. Thank you so much for tuning in today, and please join us again tomorrow at 10 for another edition of LegFX, right here on listener-supported 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR. It's 11 o'clock, so stay tuned. Fresh air is next.